This is Average Joe Finances Podcast, episode 84.
You get in position ahead of it. You start paddling, which is effectively to buy or to engage. You let it come upon you. If you pick the right one, it will pick you up and it will propel you forward at a pace faster than you can ever paddle. And you will get the natural inertia of the universe.
If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you smash that like button and click subscribe. For those of you listening on a podcast platform, be sure to subscribe on whatever platform that is and leave us a rating if you can. The more likes, ratings, and subscriptions that we get, the more we can spread the message and grow our community. So we also have a free Facebook group. It's called the Average Joe Finances Network. Check us out, join the group, join the community, ask questions, and become a part of the team. All of our other social media accounts are listed in our flow page, and we have them in the video or podcast description below.
Welcome to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. Are you trying to get out of debt, invest, or just not sure where to start? Then this is the place for you. We discuss different ways to get out of the rat race and build your wealth. Join us on this wild ride to financial freedom.
Welcome back to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cavagione. Let's get to today's episode. Hey, how's it going, everybody? So today's guest is Miles Wakeham, and he's an Australian who migrated to the USA in 1989 and has since become a multimillionaire. He lives 100% free and unconstrained life, no job, etc. You get the gist. Yet, he never graduated from high school, let alone went to college. He's a self-made, business-focused technologist who is one of the early members of the biotechnology corporation Amgen, which is now the largest biotech company in the world. He's made a fortune in Bitcoin since 2011, which is pretty cool, and owns a portfolio of rental properties. He spends 50% of his time baking in the sun in Arizona and another 50% of his time roaming the world, seeking out new opportunities. He's the host of the Unconstrained podcast, in which he teaches the art of financial sustainability to his audience. So Miles, awesome background. Really excited to have you on the show. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Absolutely. Hey, so I want to start this off the way I start every episode off with my guests. And the first question I have for you is, I gave a little bit of the wavetop description of who you are and your background, right? So if you could maybe share a little bit more about yourself, share your story. How did you get started? What made you want to just become an entrepreneur and live this unconstrained life?
I didn't know you were supposed to do anything else but that, to be honest. It's a funny situation because that question does come up, and it's taken me kind of some time to actually come together with an answer that makes sense, not only for people wanting to know the answer, but also for me. You see, I grew up at a time in Australia I sort of hit my heyday sometime in the 1980s, but I grew up in the 70s as a kid and so on. And this was in a country that had a lot of high interest rates. So nobody really had debt. You were raised on what you had and you made things work. And if your car was breaking down, you didn't go and buy another car, you fixed it. And if you couldn't afford to get somebody to fix it, you learned how to do it yourself. It was a world of the buck stops here. But with that freedom came whatever you want to do with your life is up to you. You can take things as far as you want, anywhere you want to go. And we call that free range Australians or free range kids. We were not told, no, you couldn't ride your bicycle on the street because somebody's going to hit you with the car. And yet we're in a country where everything on the ground will probably kill you, a snake or a spider or something. So you're raised with this sense of responsibility, and you're raised with this hostile environment around you. And rather than shying away from that, well, you really can't, you have no choice. At my time when I grew up, and certainly all of my peers, my friends then, this is how we were with life. We just knew the buck stops on our desk and we'll do whatever we have to do to make things work. Once you transcend that and you accept that, the world's your oyster. And I think that was kind of how that kind of was the foundation I started with.
Okay. Yeah. Right on. So that is, you know, when you think about when you're describing, you know, where you grew up in Australia, how, you know, everything just in general. So you had the high interest rates that you were talking about. Right. But you lived more of you already started off unconstrained, right? With this free range, as you called it, right? Free range, just being able to go out, not having a fear for what's around you, but being responsible enough to understand the dangers that were around. Uh-huh. And it's funny what you said about how nearly everything on the ground there can kill you. It's a running joke that my wife and I have every time she says she wants to visit Australia. And I'm like, why? So everything there that, you know, so we can go visit a place where everything there wants to kill us. But it's funny because, you know, when you think about some of the most dangerous and poisonous animals in the world, they all happen to reside in this one place down under. So when you mentioned that, it triggered that in my head. So
it's a good observation. And one of the things that comes from being raised in an environment like that is a sense of balance. Like you have to coexist with nature. Nature's not going to do what you want it to do. You have to accommodate it. And I tell a story to my audience about when I was a teenager. I grew up on the coast, on a city on the coast in Australia, where all of my friends, we went surfing every weekend. And surfing's a great way. It's a great analogy for life. I mean, it taught me pretty much everything that's worked for me in my life, which is weird. You know, you've got people out there, they go and get an MBA at Harvard and they do all this sort of stuff and they think they've got it. They've got the secret to success in life. And maybe some do, but I can tell you right now, most of the world that we're raised in is a distraction from the universe that we all live in. You know, the urban cities are artificial. I live in Arizona. It's a hostile environment. Humans not supposed to live here, but we created an artificial environment. And all around us, we're distracted by artificial. And the reason why that's important is that, getting back to the surfing analogy, when you learn how to surf, it hurts. You're going to get beaten up. You're going to get a surfboard hitting you in the back of the head. You're going to get big waves crashing and breaking every bone you've got. And I mean, it's tough. But what happens after you've done it enough and you've had your bruises and your aches and pains is you start understanding that you can't control the wave or the ocean. The ocean will always be there and it will do what oceans do, right? Waves will rise, waves will break. And what you start realizing is that in order for you to ride a wave, you have to be ahead of it. You have to be ahead of it and you have to move forward before it comes upon you. And then if you're in the right place moving forward, it will pick you up and the energy of the universe will transfer to you and you'll have the greatest ride of your life. And it's almost like a spiritual experience. Anybody who's been surfing will understand this.
Wow. I really like that. I really like that analogy, how you do that. Like the transfer of the power, you know, when you actually catch that wave and you're riding it in, that is that's a really great way to think about it.
Well, it's synergistic. You mm-hmm. become at one with the universe around you. You can't tell the wave not to be a wave. You have to deal with it. If you take right. the exact same analogy into the financial markets, you're a billionaire. You buy something before it happens. You see it rising on the horizon. You get in position ahead of it. You start paddling, which is effectively to buy or to engage. You let it come upon you. If you pick the right one, it will pick you up and it will propel you forward at a pace faster than you can ever paddle. And you will get the natural inertia of the universe. It's how I made my money with Bitcoin. It's how I made my money in real estate. It's how I've made my money, period. And anybody out there who says, oh, I've got to go and, you know, get this degree or learn this thing or whatever, I come back to the, you know, I'm a simple guy. I come back to the basics. What's your end game? What are you trying to achieve? And is this going to propel you there at the greatest momentum with the greatest pace? And for me, I learned those tricks as a learning up in Australia, growing up in Australia as a surfer.
Yeah, that and what a great analogy, right? When you talk about just the wave itself and how you can't tell the wave to not be a wave, like you said, right? It's going to do what it's going to do. You can't stop it. You don't have the power to do that. But what you do have the power to do is, you know, conform to that energy, make it your own, and then use it and to propel yourself forward, right? And you know, and you mentioned how, you know, this is how you've treated your financial just mentality as well, right? When it came to investing in Bitcoin and real estate. Now, I wanted to ask you because now, you know, when we talk about your background, you had invested in Bitcoin back in 2011. Mm-hmm. So you obviously saw this little swell that was coming up and you're like, this is going to be a good wave to catch. I'm going to paddle, you know, I'm going to start turning now so I can catch this and not, you know, have this thing just roll over me. So what did you see back in 2011 that said, okay, this is it. I'm going to go in Bitcoin.
Well, I was a real estate owner in 2008. I had a lot of rental properties and I watched them get decimated by the banking industry. So I already began anything after that with a very much a mistrust of banking. I didn't believe that putting my money with or my assets with other people or being tied to the risk of a counterparty defaulting on me, because I mean, I did nothing to deserve losing half my net worth in real estate. That was somebody else. So I knew that if I was using a counterparty, there was an advantage in using them and I needed their money, but there was also a downside risk that I put on my faith and trust that they do the right thing. Clearly they didn't. So I came out of that quite stressed out and quite, you know, broken, and realized at some point in time that maybe there's got to be a better way. So I was following a guy from my home country who also happened to be in the technology industry. He came a little after me, but I knew of him and I knew of the people he associated with, and that was Julian Assange. And I had been following what he was doing because WikiLeaks about this time had started to really get some exposure. And I sort of realized that he published a whole bunch of things that upset tons of countries and state departments and whatever all over the world. And then they had done this thing with the banks to shut him down. They'd stopped Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. Everyone was not allowed to send him money. Now, I work in the technology industry and I run I have a cluster of servers in a data center. I did then. And he had the same thing, but his was in Sweden. And I knew how much it costs to keep the servers running and the bandwidth and the power and everything. So I said, you know what, I'm going to ship, you know, give him some money. I'm going to donate. Well, I couldn't. And so after I started realizing that there was this problem that the banking industry had effectively shut down his ability to operate, I sort of said, this isn't right. I mean, it's, look, whether you agree or you disagree with what his morals were or his intention, I think it's clear that any exposure or transparency on things that were going on back then were positive for society in some way. So I said, well, there's got to be a way to do it. And then he himself had come up and said, well, there's this thing called Bitcoin. Now, he came from a thing called the cypherpunk movement, which is the encryption guys, the guys who develop all that technology to keep us encrypted. And if you know anything about history, encryption is the reason why societies were able to exist in a Soviet environment. For example, in the 1970s in Prague, in Czech Republic, they created a parallel society there that it could exist within the confines of communism. They actually had the ability to thrive. They had their own economy, their own money, their own communications. And it was based on surrounding yourself in encryption. And this sort of thing is what we would often call it, maybe the dark web, or we would call it some sort of encrypted place. But the reason why it's important is that Assange faced the same restriction in his ability to publish and to communicate and to have commerce or to be able to pay for things because third-party banks and so on were shutting him down. So what did he do? He went to Bitcoin. He discovered the white paper in 2009 through his work within that community, and he made it known. And I learned from that. Now, meanwhile, I was facing a very similar problem. I had a guy working for me who was living in Bangladesh, programmer. Now, this is the post-9/11 period. You've got any Muslim country is being considered a risk from a State Department perspective in the United States. And yet I needed to, this guy was a brilliant programmer. He was doing great work for me. I needed to pay him. So I needed to get money over to him. And it so happens that this intersection of what was going on with the cypherpunks and Assange, and then I found myself in exactly the same situation. Bangladesh was considered a terrorist country. It didn't have reciprocal banking agreements. I couldn't PayPal the guy, and he's doing great work, and I need to send him money. How do I do it? Initially, I managed to wire money to him, but it was costing me between $50 and $75 per wire, and he wanted to be paid every week. And this was stupid. So either I wire him a big ton of money and then trust that he's not going to abscond and do it, which he wouldn't. He was a good guy. But then we both together said, well, what about Bitcoin? Okay. So I said, well, look, I tell you what, I'm going to do something because I'm going to send Assange some. So I've got to buy some of this stuff. I need to send you something. It's going to cost me $75 to wire money to anybody. The only exchange at that time was in Japan. So I just said, you know what? It's not expensive. I think it was like $7 each at the time. I'll just buy hundreds of these things. So because it doesn't make sense for me to not have a stockpile because I'm going to use it like a checking account. I'm just going to pay you with it, pay you with it, pay you with it. And I started realizing, whoa, this is really cool. But not just because of what it could do. There was no bank. There was no counterparty. You held the private keys yourself. You were your own bank. It was amazing, and it had efficacy. It had absolute relevance for what I needed to do transactionally at the time. The problem was that years later, as the price started going up, and then you've got all of these scammers and hackers and all this stuff in there, and you're in the Wild West. I mean, this is frontier land. But remember, I'm from the country where everything's going to kill you, right? If I can handle living in the Wild West, well, I can. I mean, I'm willing to do it. So I said, okay, buy a ton of this stuff. I had it transferred to an exchange in Hong Kong. I was paying everybody I needed to pay with this. The world was great. Everyone was happy. And then the price went kabam. And I'm like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be using this now to transact. That was my first mistake. The thing is, the reason why the price went up is because everyone found it to be very valuable for what it was doing. If you start holding it and you don't move the Bitcoin around, well, the price stops going up. It just sort of flatlines. But what was happening was that everybody was starting to get the wind of, I should buy some. I should, So the price went to 1,000 and then 2,000, and by sometime around about 2017, I think it went to like $20,000. And I'm sitting on this stash and I'm going, wow, that was easy. I didn't deserve to win this. This was a purposeful transaction with an intent that was not to walk away with a ton of money, but it was to be able to empower those that had no voice. And I still to this day believe that really is the reason why it should exist. But, now we're talking $50,000 Bitcoin. Right. Human greed comes in and all of that. And you're like, I don't know if I want to be dealing with this now. It's a bit too stressful,
It's kind of like, as Bob Ross would call it, a happy little accident. We're going to turn this into a little money tree now, right? So, yeah. Wow, what a way to really get in before it was really a thing. Because I started looking at Bitcoin probably around 2016 when it was getting up into the thousands, right? The lower thousands. I think when I was looking at it, when I first started looking at it in 2016, it was around $4,000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then when it shot up to 20,000, I was like, oh, there's no way it's ever going to go higher than that. That's crazy. And then it dropped back down to about 12. And then you look at it today and it's in the 50s. It's crazy. But again, like you said, it's because it's moving around. It's not because it's, you know, a whole bunch of people are buying it and holding it and it's stagnating. It's because it's changing, you know, ownership. They're moving from wallet to wallet. So, and that's the only way to get the value of it to go up. But now it's also, the way I look at it too, it's also a scarcity mindset now, because the value of it's also going up because there is a limit to how much they can make, and they're getting close to that. Right. So, very interesting. Like I've had a couple guests on recently to talk about crypto a bit. And each one of those conversations was very interesting. And I felt like I learned a lot, but I still feel like I don't know a darn thing about crypto and blockchain and everything. So you finding it that early is, and your reasoning for doing it too, like you had valid reasons. It wasn't like, oh, I think this is going to be an up and coming thing. It's like, no, this is useful. I can utilize this to, you know, pay somebody that works for me and things like that. So you found a use for it that worked. And, you know, you had that happy little accident happen, right? When it shot up in value. So that's fantastic. So I know you said you were also in real estate, right? So you said back in 2008, one of the things I wrote down here in my notes is you lost your shirt in 2008 with real estate. And that's what made you start looking at some other things. So so what do you still own? Because we talk about your background, right? So it said that you still have some real estate assets. So in 2008, like what shifted for you? Did you have to do like a sell-off? Did you say, okay, hey, this is an opportunity now to buy some more discounted properties? How did that affect you when the real estate market crashed?
Let's take a brief moment to hear from our show sponsors.
What's going on, everybody? So today I want to talk to you about the podcast editing service that we use for the Average Joe Finances podcast. That is editpods.com. And what I really like about them is it's a subscription-based service, so the prices are fantastic. And not only do they do the podcast episodes for us, but they also make us videos, audiograms, social media caption videos. They do our show notes, thumbnails. It's just fantastic products. Go check them out at editpods.com. What's going on, everybody? So I know there's a lot of busy individuals out there like myself. I find myself sometimes struggling with time management when I'm dealing with things with my blog, my podcast, managing my social media accounts. Sometimes it can be really taxing and time consuming. So one of the things I started doing recently that has been super helpful is outsourcing some of this work to subcontractors and freelancers. And I'm doing that through a website called Fiverr. I have a link in the podcast description below that will take you to Fiverr and give you a discount up to $100 off your first order with them. Check it out. It's been a lifesaver for me. It's been saving me a lot of time and a lot of stress, and I really think it could do the same for you. Check out the link below or go to www.averagejoefinances.com/Fiverr, Fiverr.
Let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. Whether it's single or multifamily real estate, the stock market, or side hustles, we discuss it all. Strap in and enjoy the ride.
Well, I was in a very unusual situation prior to that. So my wife and I are both from Australia. And in the mid-1990s, I had a house in Australia that I owned pretty much freehold. And then I found myself on a plane to the United States after I'd lived in Southern California for 6 years in the early 90s. And then I went back to Australia and then I eventually returned in 99. But I had this house that was bought and sitting in Australia. So I had to put somebody in it. I had to find a tenant to occupy it while I was off with my family having my next round of adventures around the country, around the world. So I learned how rental supposedly works. In reality, I learned how it didn't work. But that was okay because one way or another, I was learning. And then by about 2001, 2002, we had made some money in the United States. And the exchange rate was really advantageous to the US. At one point, I think probably the worst point in time, the Australian dollar was trading at about 48 cents to one US dollar. So I was in the United States making all my money in the US, thinking now everything's at a 50% discount back in Australia. So we'd go back to see family, and we'd learn through talking to people and knowing from our own history about the country what was going on and what we could see as the future. And so we ended up punting on three single-family homes that were in our hometown in an area we thought was going to get some growth. As it happens, it did quite substantially. So I had these three properties, actually four properties in Australia. And then the problem was the rental market down there was very controlled by the government. There was almost like rent control, and there was kind of a negative attitude to landlords and a real pro-tenant mindset. And we found that the properties never really cash flowed. They should have, based on the amount of money we put in there and what they were getting and yielding in rent, but they just weren't. And that kind of surprised me. I felt like the property managers were letting me down, or that the natural environment of the economy wasn't working, because I did all what I thought was the right things with this on a spreadsheet, but it just wasn't working out. Well, you know, that's how life is most of the time. You know, anything planned on a spreadsheet has about a 50% chance of going correct, and probably that is even overstating it. But the truth is, the equity value in these properties were going up, because right at that time, Australia started to export all of its natural commodities to China. And that just kept growing and growing and growing. And there was a lot of money sloshing around in the economy. And so the value of these properties went up. So we had then done the exact same thing in Phoenix. We had bought half a dozen properties in Phoenix. They were cash flowing, but their equity wasn't really going anywhere, not substantial. And certainly when 2008 happened, all of the properties we held in Arizona or in the United States just crashed. So equity was not wiped out, but certainly my LTV positions were, you know, underwater. So anyway, long story short, we decided we'd sell the properties we had in Australia, we'd cash out, and we'd pay out any obligation of debt to the banks that we had in the US. Well, because the properties tripled in value in Australia, I bought them at 50 cents on the dollar because of the exchange rate, I did pretty well out of that. So not only did we have enough money to clear all of our position and settle things down in the US in 2008, but we had this big surplus of cash. So I remember sitting out in the veranda having a cup of coffee in the morning with my wife one day, and I said to her, you know, everybody around here is freaking out. No one wants to touch real estate with a 10-foot pole. It's like the spawn of the devil. You know, I'm going to go the opposite way. I understand this one thing in life that I can count on, and this is coming from that universal truth, and that is that, you know, if you have a study like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you'll know that the lowest level in the pyramid is the physiological need of food, shelter, clothing. I like the business of shelter, because it doesn't matter whether the economy's up, the economy's down, people still need a roof over their head. And I believed strongly in that. So I said, okay, I'm going to go to the local court auctions they had. They had these auctions in Phoenix, which were a bit of a trip. Guy with a, you know, 10-gallon hat on out there with a clipboard going, who wants this? Who wants it? You know, a couple other guys going, yeah, I'll have it. I'll have it. So I'm sticking my hand up. I'm just buying everything in sight. I ended up buying a street, just a street of multifamily properties. And I got them for pennies on the dollar compared to what they were, what I thought they were worth, because I believed in food, shelter, clothing, basic physiological need. And so I did that. And I walked away with all these titles and a whole bunch of refurb and, you know, maintenance work and rebuilding and whatever. But that was fine. We did that. And 3 years later, those properties went up five times what I paid them. And I bought so many of them that I was an instant multimillionaire from doing it. And still to this day, I've got properties I bought for like $75,000 that are worth $700,000 now.
Wow.
I mean, again, it's the wave, right? The surfer.
Well, it's also, you know, that is the exact principle that Warren Buffett talks about with his, you know, his famous quote about be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful, right? So in 2008, when all this stuff was happening, you see everybody like getting out of real estate because they were fearful of what was happening. And you looked at that and said, no, this is an opportunity. And you jumped in, you know, you went all in, bought like a whole street, which is really cool. So just hearing you describe, you know, how you, you know, pushed forward in real estate while the market was crashing just immediately brings me to that and immediately just says, you know, you did the exact thing that somebody with a millionaire mindset or success mindset will do. Right. So that is super cool. And you know, it goes back to what you discussed about your background and growing up in Australia, right? So even when you were talking about Bitcoin, you know, I'm going to rewind a little bit to that too, how it became kind of like the wild, wild west, right? And even in real estate, you know, back in 2008, that was similar. It was like the wild, wild west. It was, you know, every man for themselves, right? And you said, okay, well, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to take action and I'm going to take over this area because that's what I need to do at this time. So 2008. So it's funny because I wrote this note, you know, lost your shirt in real estate in 2008 when that was absolutely not the case. It started off that way, but, you know, well, not really for you because the properties you bought were back in Australia when you first started. So even in 2008, when that happened, you were able to sell those assets because the market here wasn't affecting the market over there. And, correct. You know, it's unfortunate that we had like these banks with these predatory lending practices, which is what caused it. And that's why like a lot of people have asked me too, like if they, you know, what my thoughts are on the real estate market right now is another 2008 coming? And the reason why I think it's not is because this is different. This is different than what it was before. We're now looking at a surplus of money hitting the real estate market because of the lower interest rates. When the market regulates itself, which we're starting to see some markets start to like plateau and start to flatline again, I don't think we're going to see this huge drop off the side of a cliff. I think it's going to stabilize and then it's going to start going back to the normal, you know, 2-3% per year growth rate versus this, you know, 25-50% that we're seeing.
Well, let me ask a question.
Sure.
See that a crash in the market's a bad thing? Same chart in 2020, 20 years later, only about 20% of the markets in the world would say that their main trading partner is the United States. 80% are trading with China. China owns everything. So as a result, the US, and we will also, let's also include Canada and Mexico and Western Europe in that. Let's say there's an alliance. They want to be able to retain their identity and their sovereignty, right? We're proud Americans. We want to retain that. So meanwhile, we're battling against the global financial world who wants to have your manufacturing done in Shenzhen or Beijing or wherever. And yet we know that ultimately that doesn't serve our interests philosophically, ideologically, or economically, right? It serves the interests of a corporation that's trying to make more money for its shareholders, but it's a short-term play that could lose our entire economy in the process. The reason why I feel that Mexico is an important player in this is that the United States will move its trading alliances from China away from China to trading partners that are in the same time zone, within easy transporting proximity to the US, and that ideally have favorable trading agreements with the US. And I look at all of the countries, and it's clear to me that the number one is Mexico. So what do? Well, I go to Mexico. I spend a lot of time in Mexico. I'm learning Spanish. I go down there. I get to know the people. I get to know the culture. I get my residency status in Mexico. I go and buy real estate in Mexico, and I watch the trade routes. I watch the roads. I watch the rail. I watch the sea platforms. And then I go to cities like Querétaro, which is the fastest growing city in Latin America. And what do I find there? Massive corporations investing billions and billions of dollars to build manufacturing hubs there that would rival Shenzhen. All of this tells me that the Mexican middle class economy is on the rise. People can get jobs where they couldn't have before. They can become upwardly mobile. They can afford to send their kids to college. They've got free healthcare down there. They're already set for that. But there's a positive future. You talk to anybody in country there, they will have a big smile on their face and they will tell you how good the future will be. I can't get that in Phoenix, right? And that's the difference. That alone, for a contrarian, for a surfer, is why I've gone down there and started paddling, because I know that market will be the next wave, but it won't be a small wave. It could be a tsunami. And that's how I operate. Now, I could be wrong. What's the worst that's going to happen? I'm going to own a ton of land down there that I can have a nice time by the beach. Okay, fine. But you see, what I'm trying to say is that this is the mindset of somebody who doesn't want to live a constrained life, right? This is not the mindset of somebody who said, I need to go to college to get a degree so I could get a, quote, good job. A good job is enslavement. I'm not going to give 40 or 50 hours of my time to one client because the client could go away, right? I'm going to retain my ownership of me and my time and my life, and I'm going to have the world serve me. And no, it's not selfish. It's not. It's being responsible. Because if I understand the universe and how the universe works, it'll be there long after I'm gone. But what if I learn to surf the wave and let the universe serve me? Because it doesn't cost anything to ride a wave, right? So this is how my head works. I go into these regions that most people would fear to go in, and I get to know the region, and I buy in if I feel that there's an upside, and I sit back and I watch. It's how it happened with Bitcoin. It's how it happened with real estate. It is even how it happened in technology in my world. And that's how I get 100 times on my earning, not 100%, 100 times. When I bought Bitcoin, I made 1,100 times what I invested in it. That's not somebody patting themselves on the back because they bought Vanguard VTSAX and got 15% on the markets. Yippee, it's a bull market. Everyone's making money. No, how about 1,100 times what you put into it? How would you like that? Because it's out there for anybody who wants to surf the wave and becomes at one with the universe. Very simple.
Wow. Wow. That is a lot to take in. So, you know, you talk about this mindset you have, right? This unconstrained mindset. And, you know, you're looking for, you know, what is the future going to look like in the next, you're not talking like 10, 20, 30 years from now. You're saying, hey, in the next 2 to 3 years, like that's what you're looking at right now. So you're looking at out at the ocean, looking for that swell, like which wave is going to be the right wave for me to catch? Because you can catch plenty of waves. It doesn't mean it's going to be a good ride in, right? Right. It's a matter of catching the right wave. Like, oh, this is the one. This is going to be the big hammer, right? So, you know, and what you're doing right now is you've identified potentially, you know, what can be a really, really significant wave, and you're paddling out towards it. So that is something that, you know, when we've talked about on this show several times about mindset, right? And this is a different way of looking at your mindset and trying to become, you know, not just one with the universe, but one with yourself, right? Really listen to yourself. And, you know, you're doing that with this unconstrained mindset. So I want to talk about that. You know, actually, I'd like to ask you about this unconstrained mindset, right? So what is an unconstrained mindset?
It's when you transcend everything that's constraining you. And the simplest way of putting it is that anywhere in the world, there are different things. If you lived in sub-Saharan Africa, what would constrain you would be, well, I need food to eat and I need water and I need a roof over my head for my family. That would constrain you. If you can achieve all of those things, you're unconstrained and you go to that position of, well, now what, right? The now what place. In the United States, we have very similar problems. We're constrained by a social mantra that says, go to school, study hard, get a degree, get a job, work hard, save. And at the ripe old age of 65, you can go out there and retire and live in the Florida or whatever. The reality is that our life expectancy is dropping, not going up. And if you look at the CDC numbers, we've got an average US male has a life expectancy of 75.3 years today. And yet we have a government telling us that we would like you to not take your Social Security until 67. Well, what's what that 8 years? You've got 8 years to live with this. You worked all your life for this and you're going to get 8 years. Meanwhile, you've got a bad back, a bad hip, so you can't go to Europe and do the bucket list and all this sort of thing. And then you're sitting around living life in regret. You see, I don't like to live life in regret. I mean, there's a lot of things in my life I would have changed, I would have done differently, that I've learned that I was too young or too immature or just made a stupid idea, stupid decision. There's a lot that's worked for me. There's a lot that haven't, but it's because of the things that haven't. If I was able to debrief and learn from that, then eventually you kind of weed them out and then most of the things you start doing work. But the one thing that I honestly have to say is that you can't live life in regret. And if you're on some glide path right now where just turning up to work every day and dealing with a boss you can't stand and workmates you barely tolerate, I mean, if that's your world and you think this is life, then I think you need to start taking the red pill, because at some point that you just can't exist like that. That's not a life. It's not an unconstrained life, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember when I was thinking about this whole concept of trying to bottle it, trying to make it understandable for people. It came about because my daughter, who graduated college, did the polar opposite of what I did. And at the end of graduation, her and all her friends came to me and said, what should we do? And it was like, well, I thought you would have known. That's why you went and spent $100,000 to get a degree. No, we had no idea. Well, there's what you should do. You need to go get a backpack and get your ass to Europe and spend 2 years running around the place, learning how the world works and learning who you are. And then eventually you'll come back and go, don't answer that. I know what I have to do, right? That's what the missing link most of us don't have. And the point is, you can't teach that. You can tell stories of people who did it. You can learn from other people's experiences. But it's not a professor in a college that's going to tell you how your life will work like that. And with this whole concept of being unconstrained, I realized that there's an end game. And for me, we all have to know what that is. We have to have a mission. What is our mission? What do we as individuals choose our direction to be? Not what somebody tells you it should be, or what your smartphone says, or what your followers on Instagram are doing, but what do you want? What ultimately makes you happy? If you have that mission and you are working towards it, and you can take all of the things that constrain you, that stop you getting to it, and you can push them aside and get them out of the way, you will achieve it, right? But if you can't, because there's more month than money every, you know, and 78% of people are living paycheck to paycheck and all this sort of thing, they've got no hope of seeking that out. My goal here is to give them a reset option to say, stop it. What you're doing isn't working. You have to swallow your pride, suck up that maybe you made a mistake, and before it's too late, you have to put some perspective on what really you should be doing is. And if you're not doing that, you will never be happy and you will always be constrained. So my whole concept of being unconstrained and what I try to talk about and evangelize with other people is really just a question of what do you value? What's most important to you? Because as much as we're your show's about money and I talk a lot about money, money's a tactic. It's not a strategy, right? If you've got all the money in the world, the last thing you care about is money.
Right. It's a tool. It's a means to an end.
Exactly. I mean, I love doing what I do because I learn about the world, about me, about the universe, about things that react, right? It's like a puzzle. It's like a riddle. And I love that. I love getting out and trying to solve puzzles like that. It's not because I want to make $1 billion. That's not going to help me. What's going to help me is that I discovered something that I never knew existed that I fell in love with. It might be art or people or culture or something that was never there because I never chose to physically engage with it. But if I got the money out of the way, I got all the time in the world to physically engage with these things. And then the world looks like a much happier place, man.
Absolutely. You know, Miles, I really like the Matrix analogy that you gave too. You know, take the red pill, especially now that they're coming out with a new Matrix movie this December. Yeah. and actually, by the time this episode airs, the movie's already out, so go check it out. Now, but hey, this conversation has been absolutely amazing. Like, I'm looking at my notes here and like the list of questions I wanted to ask you, and just having this conversation, pretty much all of them got answered. And I'd even have to ask you some of the questions that I had written down here to ask you. And we got into like everything. And the value that you add with, you know, what you're discussing about this unconstrained mindset is invaluable, right? It's just something that somebody can take and just really change their lives. And I really like your way of thinking. It's fantastic. So there's going to be people listening to this episode that are going to want to know more about Miles and this unconstrained mindset. And I understand you have a podcast as well that talks about this. So where can people find more information about you, listen to your podcast? Do you have any social media or anything like that you can share with us?
Yeah, I do everything from my website, which is called beunconstrained.com. So from that point, if somebody goes to that website, they can go to everything. They'll find me on various social media. They'll find where they can subscribe to my podcast, but you can get it on Spotify or iTunes or whatever. I also do another podcast I sort of do like a subscriber program for people who are on Patreon. That is a secondary podcast I do every week, which is called This Week in Freedom. It's designed to unearth the opportunities that I see on a daily basis and the risks that I see as well, and to try and give somebody a bit of it's like local knowledge from the guy who lives by the ocean. You want to go surfing, but before you make that long trip down to the beach and find out that the waves are flat and it was a waste of time, you call the guy up who's looking out of his window and he says, yeah, there's some surf there, or you know, it's really good today, or no, it's crap, you don't need that. Well, that's kind of what I do on This Week in Freedom in that podcast. I'm kind of the local knowledge guy. And everything that I talk about, everything that I write about, everything that people can find me talking about is real experience. I'm not talking academically about something that I haven't done. Every single thing that I talk about is something I did or I am doing, and I can give people like the step-by-step on it. There's value in that knowledge. I hope there is anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And it all comes back to surfing with you. And I love it. What you're doing is you're providing real world experience, not just something that you read about or learned about and you want to share with other people. This is you know, from the experience of Miles, the things that you've gone through or you're currently doing right now, which is absolutely awesome. And that provides a lot of value to those that want to listen and get that information. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us. So for everybody that's listening right now, I'm going to make sure that the link is in the show notes. Go check it out. Listen to his podcast. I really hope that you all enjoyed this episode. I certainly enjoyed this interview because Miles is just he's the whole package. And I just want to say again, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to have this conversation with me.
Oh, no, anytime. I appreciate it. I'm honored to be on your show.
Absolutely. Hey, so we're out of here. Aloha from Hawaii. Thank you for making it to the end of this episode. Greatly appreciate you being here with me today on the Average Joe Finances podcast. If you haven't done so yet, make this the episode that you go leave us a 5-star rating or subscribe to our YouTube channel. The Average Joe Finances podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Have an outstanding day.
Thanks for listening to the Average Joe Finances Podcast, your source for beating debt, saving money, and investing. Learn more at averagejoefinances.com.